This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. My name is Raymond Grenfell. And before we get started, though, a huge, huge thanks to Jeff for another excellent edition of On The Record. It's always such a pleasure hearing Jeff bringing it On The Record on a Monday morning. But of course, you can catch On The Record every weekday here at RTR FM from 9 in the AM. As I said, my name is Raymond Grenfell, and in the studio, I have one of the new Indie Media co-presenters, co-producers, Journey.
G'day.
How you going?
Yeah, I'm good. It's a beautiful day outside. It's good to be here.
Yeah, no, thanks so much for coming in and getting involved in the show. We've got a few new people joining Indie Media. It's really exciting. Some of us, you know, older folks like myself and Alex, gives us a bit of a chance to take a little bit of time off. But it's good to be back in the studio. Got quite a exciting show today with all sorts of things, some positive, some more dystopian. What are we going to be chatting about today, Journey?
Oh, we've got a chat about the recent Identify and Disrupt bill that was passed by the federal government, which allows the federal police to come in and take control of your social media account, a bunch of stuff like that.
Yeah, pretty terrifying stuff. And it's really just sort of slipped under the radar. I don't think it's really received the media attention or the public scrutiny that it should have. I mean, this is, it means that people, the police can ostensibly, for a whole range of reasons, take over your social media accounts, delete information and so forth. And there's a lot of people that are potentially going to be affected by this, including, of course, activists, unions, and others. Quite scary stuff. So we'll be talking a little bit about that later in the show. Also, another bill that is very worrying and it definitely isn't getting the attention it deserves is the new mutual obligations bill that's been attempted to be pushed through by the federal government. It's got all the hallmarks of another robo-debt scheme, and it's a new online employment services model. But there's a lot of concerns around it that it's very confusing. It will mean that people on Centrelink payments will end up being further penalised and demonised. So a little later in the show, we're going to be chatting about that.
We've also got a chat with sexologist and trans activist Kai Schweitzer about the recent Australian census and how it excluded trans and intersex folks, which can lead to all sorts of
problems for people.
Sorry, I'm new to this.
No. It is a difficult thing, you know, because it's a complex, the ways in which people are represented and validated through these official sort of institutions.
Yeah, essentially, when we are invisible, there are no services for us, and trans and intersex people often require quite specific services for their needs, and it seems the government is deliberately leaving us out of that, conversation.
And that's one thing. I mean, when I did my census, I was like, oh God, why do I have to do this? But it is, the thing that is referenced to apply services, and then if an entire group of people are just totally not even in existence in the census, then, I guess it is very worrying in terms of potential services for trans and intersex people. So anyway, a jam-packed show this morning on Indie Media.
Last month, a federal bill to create new police powers to spy on criminal suspects online, disrupt their data and take over their accounts was passed in the Senate. The Surveillance Legislation Amendment, Identify and Disrupt Bill, proposes, amongst other things, that officers could take control of an online account and impersonate someone. The bill also allows officers to disrupt data by modifying, adding, copying, or deleting in order to frustrate suspected criminal activity. The government claims the new powers would mainly target terrorists, pedophiles, and drug traffickers operating online. Despite the intention to catch the bad guys, and with some limited amendments, digital rights activists are not convinced the bill goes far enough to protect vulnerable internet users. To help us understand what's going on here, I'm joined by Catherine Gledhill-Tucker, Noongar technologist and digital rights activist currently serving on the board of Electronic Frontiers Australia and is a campaigner for human rights across movements. Hi, Kat, how are you going?
I'm doing great, Alan. How are you going?
Yeah, good. So this is crazy stuff, isn't it? What do you know much about this and what are these new powers?
I do. I know a little bit about this from the perspective of a tech person who cares a lot about yes. human rights in Australia. So we're talking about the Surveillance Legislation Amendment, Identify and Disrupt Bill. And this gives the AFP, the Australian Federal Police, and the ACIC, the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission, three new powers for dealing with online crime. So it's this data disruption warrant, which you kind of alluded to, this idea of being able to modify, copy, add, or delete data, a network activity warrant, which allows them to infiltrate computer networks, and an account takeover warrant, which allows police to take control of an online account, like an email or social media account, and impersonate someone. And this can happen totally covertly and without consent.
It's amazing, isn't it? Like this whole concept of somebody hacking into your account. Like they, so they must have some great powers and skills to be able to just hack into your account if they think you're doing something wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And it's totally broad, overreaching powers that we haven't seen before in Australia as well. And with very little to no judicial oversight, which is the really terrifying part. So a judge's warrant isn't required in an emergency situation for a data disruption warrant, for example.
So they don't need a warrant necessarily to do this?
That's right. If it's not practicable to get a warrant, they can acquire an emergency authorization. So no one can necessarily know that this is happening and there's no judicial oversight.
So as I understand it, if you fail to comply with this, say if you're a system admin or something and you fail to comply with a request to hack into someone's account, there's up to 10 years in jail, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So say you're a system administrator, you're working for an Australian company, and the AFP ask you to comply and actively help to modify or add or copy or delete data or assist with that kind of investigation. If you refuse to comply, you can end up with 10 years in jail, wow. according to this new bill.
Yeah, and you're not allowed to tell anyone either.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, wow. Yes. You also can't tell anybody because that would risk non-compliance.
Well, this is incredible. Does this happen anywhere else in the world?
There are some parallels internationally in the UK and the US, but this is totally unprecedented in Australia. And it's happening much faster and with much less scrutiny, which is the thing that terrifies me the most. When these kind of surveillance powers come up in the United States, there's significant pushback from communities and from private sector and as well as public sector. But this has happened very swiftly in Australia, which is terrifying.
Yeah, there's not been much talk about it. I suppose COVID and surveillance powers that have come in over the last couple of years to protect us from the pandemic, I suppose, overlooks these kinds of things that go under the radar.
That's right, which feels so sinister too. While everyone is concerned about surviving a pandemic, these broad authoritarian powers are being just swiftly passed in government with no pushback from opposition either, which is extremely frustrating. For this particular bill, there were, I think, 33 recommendations from the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security released a report recommending 33 significant amendments to narrow the scope of these powers and add oversight and add those safeguards to protect people, but those amendments were ignored and the bill passed without any meaningful changes.
Wow, okay. So despite minimal opposition from Labor as well.
Exactly. And we saw the same thing happen with the online safety bill very recently as well. So what we've seen from the Labor Party and the federal government is that they will say, look, we don't agree with this and we're very unhappy. but they support the legislation and they don't make any meaningful change. There's very limited meaningful opposition that we have at the moment in our federal government.
I suppose they have to look like they're protecting us from the terrorists and the bad guys as well, don't they?
And that's the thing. And we'll always hear this, oh, we're protecting civil society's safety. Mm. We're protecting you from terrorism and pedophiles and other kinds of criminal activity. And if you speak up against this legislation, then what are you pro-terrorism? but the conversation always comes back to safety. But if we think about this from the perspective of well-being of people and human rights, this is certainly doesn't support the well-being of people. And well-being, I would argue, definitely covers safety, but it encompasses so many more things as well. Our freedom to be individuals and our freedom to have access to a democratic society is certainly being undermined, certainly in the name of safety.
Yeah, well, it completely undermines the ability to be an individual when they can take over your account and pretend to be somebody else. It's almost catfishing.
Exactly.
The federal cops can catfish. Very disturbing.
Exactly. And there's these incredible chilling effects from legislation like this. So if you're an activist or a whistleblower, you'll be less likely to want to speak up, or your democratic freedoms are being compromised as well. And I think that seems to me the intention of this kind of legislation. It isn't keeping people safe. It's protecting the government from any kind of contention from activists and whistleblowers.
Well, as I understand it, there's enough legislative powers for the cops to be able to take down criminals such as that already. You don't need these new powers.
Exactly. And that's always the question that I ask when this kind of legislation comes up, is prove to me that you are unable to do your job with the powers that you currently have before you ask for more.
Mm.
And how do we know that these agencies aren't going to misuse or abuse these powers? I think there's very little trust in agencies like the ACIC and the AFP to work in the favour of the well-being of the community.
Yeah, we saw that here in WA with our Safe WA app, the QR code that we use to get into venues and shops, etc., where the WA police use that data to investigate a criminal activity.
Exactly.
So it does happen, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And that was after we were explicitly told this data from this tool, this piece of technology will only be used for contact tracing. We were specifically told that. And then it happened anyway. This kind of misuse of trust and misuse of broad reach into people's lives, it shows me that there's just such utter contempt for the agency and autonomy of individual people.
Absolutely. And it was highlighted also with the Snowden affair, and who worked with the NSA and various US government departments or agencies, learn all about how they hack their citizens freely. So this it's done. It's you can't really trust the government to do what they say. They just don't always do it.
Yeah, that's right. And the most difficult thing and the hardest thing in Australia is that we don't currently have a federally enforceable human rights framework.
Yes.
So we don't have that fallback. We don't have a Bill of Rights like the United States have. And we only have a kind of vague implied right to freedom, for example, in Australia. It's not enshrined in our constitution. And until we have that, until we have a federally enforceable human rights framework, any more surveillance legislation needs to be tabled. It just needs to stop until we can be confident that we can protect the human rights of people in Australia.
Well, I guess the concept of human rights goes right into digital rights as well, doesn't it? Because we live such a life now that's ubiquitous. It's hyper-connected and mandatory to be connected. So those human rights need to carry, don't they, across to our user accounts and our life online?
Yes, certainly. And digital rights are simply human rights in a digital context. Technology is so pervasive in our lives, in our home lives, in our work lives, in our schools. They can't be treated as separate things. And it seems so much easier for this kind of legislation to be rolled out in a digital context, where if it were in a physical context, it would get much more scrutiny. And for some reason, that's not treated the same way in terms of digital or kind of tech surveillance legislation.
Yeah, it's almost like you've got a federal policeman standing behind you when you're on the internet, you know, maybe just playing with the keyboard and, yeah, just doing things to your computer while you're just on the net.
That's exactly what's happening. You know, a policeman's just coming into your house, opening up your laptop and deleting some files, adding some new ones and saying, don't worry about it, I'm allowed to do this.
It's almost comical. It's not, though. It's not comical, but it is happening. Though, what can we do? What do you have any call to actions as to what we should do as general citizens with these sweeping powers?
Certainly. And I don't want it to be all doom and gloom. There's certainly things that we can do as individual people. There's currently a petition on GetUp at the moment to repeal this Identify and Disrupt bill. And the more signatures, you know, the more power we can put behind this and actually send a bit of a message to Parliament to say that we're not okay with this surveillance state situation. You can write to your MP and say that you're concerned about the lack of individual rights in this legislation and ask that the legislation actually be referred to the INSLM for a human rights impact assessment. And you can support the work of individual organisations that are constantly keeping on top of this kind of legislation and the surveillance and privacy and digital rights in Australia. So look up Electronic Frontiers Australia and Digital Rights Watch. Just keep in touch with them and see what campaigns they're doing. And yeah, we just get in touch with that kind of community.
You just heard Indie Media's Alan Boyd chatting to Catherine Gledhill-Tucker, Noongar technologist and digital rights activist currently serving on the board of Electronic Frontiers Australia. You can find EFA at efa.org.au, where there is a comprehensive talk on the ramifications of the Identify and Disrupt Bill.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
The recent Australian census left a lot of people in LGBTQIA plus communities feeling deliberately erased and excluded from the survey, with several questions leaving out appropriate options for these communities. Particularly for transgender, intersex and other gender diverse folks, the question asking what gender or sex a person was vague, incorrect and incomplete, leaving these already discriminated against and vulnerable communities out of important national data. Many believe that this absence will lead to inferior services and supports for trans, intersex and gender diverse people. I've got trans advocate, sexologist and youth worker Kai Schweitzer here from Youth Pride Network and the Youth Homelessness Advisory Council to chat about some of the ways the census has excluded our communities. G'day Kai, how are you today?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
I am good, thanks. So could you sum up for us the ways that trans people and other gender diverse people were excluded from this year's census?
Sure. So in essence, the census asked about sex assigned at birth and not about gender at all. So it was, are you male or female? And then in order to access any other option than that, there was a special little link you had to click. You had to kind of know about in advance because it's in very fine print in order to get to an additional option that was non-binary sex, which is
not a thing.
Not accurate. No, not accurate. They also gave a warning sort of, I guess, mostly to our community that just said if you tick male or female, so for example, if you are a trans woman and you tick female, you could be classed as having provided false or misleading information.
Oh, is that true?
The fine was $2,200. So that's quite concerning.
I actually didn't know that, and now I'm a bit worried about that because that's what I did.
Yeah, well, hopefully that doesn't happen. I feel like they would have to find an awful lot of people and go to an awful lot of effort.
Yeah,
it was a potential risk for people just like being honest and authentic about who they are. And then in terms of you know, a third option, non-binary sex is not ideal because it conflates the existence of people in intersex variations with non-binary people. One is about sex, one is about gender. Mm-hmm. And it will mean that, you know, the data will not be helpful. Leaving aside the fact that the ABS has already told us that people who ticked non-binary sex will be randomly assigned male or female when the data is released. So it really was useless information to put on there in the first place if it was going to be ignored anyway. It's been a very strange and very unhelpful census in a lot of ways.
It's quite confusing. When you ticked non-binary sex, it came up with an additional box for you to put just kind of whatever you wanted in there. Do you know what will happen with that data?
So what I have read is that while the official census data is not going, it's going to randomly assign everyone, male or female, there is some talk about having a separate analysis and journal article that does actually look at that data, but it won't be included, you know, in the federal level funding and decision making. It'll just go as sort of a separate, you know, academic piece.
So it's
a necessarily as much impact.
Essentially, just throwing a bone out. Do you think that this question was designed and written this way from a place of like ignorance or like willful discrimination?
I can't see it as anything but willful discrimination based on the fact that the ABS went against their own data collection standards that they've written in order to write it this way. So the ABS actually does have really good standards for collecting sex, gender, and variations of sex characteristics and sexual orientation, all of those things. And they were really good before, and then they updated them again in January of this year with a lot of community input. And so their recommendation is to collect assignment at birth, variations of sex characteristics, gender identity, and sexual orientation, always. And obviously they have gone against their own standards in order to do that, which seems particularly sus given that, you know, that the standards are really good. They completely went against their own rules.
Yeah, right. So one can imagine that there was some political interference, perhaps from the Morrison government, going into that.
I would think so. I think trans lives are already heavily politicized, and we are sort of used as a scare tactic for conservative rhetoric. But especially right now with the sort of religious freedoms bill trying to push for people of faith to be able to discriminate against our community, I think. Not having accurate data on the number of LGBTIQA plus people is helpful to that cause, because it would have been really detrimental for them to realize how many queer people there are in Australia and how many people would potentially be put at risk by that bill. And I think, it just like helps to perpetuate the lack of political will towards, you know, making any grounds for LGBTIQA plus rights, because, it really relies on the idea that we're a small minority and therefore we don't need to be seen as a priority, when realistically the vague data that we do have suggests that we are a very large part of the population.
Absolutely.
It would be nice if we could have that in census data someday.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, like just the way that it was, that you had to click on like some words that were in the question to have the option of non-binary sex, which isn't even a thing. It was clearly hidden in a way to not appear to like upset, liberal voters, perhaps.
They were already too busy being upset and angry about the no religion option to really like notice this little fine print, I think.
Do you think this has been an issue in the past, in previous censuses? Was it an issue in the one in 2016, for instance?
Yeah, so I think just like broadly as a research nerd, trans people and LGBTQ plus people are almost never collected in data in general and have never been collected in the census prior to now. And so that was the real hope, was that the 2021 census would really give us good data. And it was sort of seen as this really exciting opportunity for a lot of people. And there was a huge campaign around it and push for it, but it just didn't happen. And it was a massive missed opportunity. But the best data that we do have right now is that about 1 in 25 people in Australia and New Zealand are trans or gender diverse. So that's a huge proportion of the population, realistically. But we don't have like the census level data to confirm that estimate. But it would have been really helpful to have that.
Yeah. Do you think that this will have like a trickle effect into support services and like access to medical care, for instance?
I think it definitely is something that we observe already, is that the lack of data means that there is a lack of funding, because there isn't any way of proving it, because the government really relies and other funding bodies really rely on hard data and evidence to confirm that there is a need. They don't really like to do preventative stuff. They like to do crisis intervention stuff. And so, you know, the best data we have shows us that when it comes to healthcare, a large proportion of trans people access some sort of transition-related care. We have very, very high rates of suicide attempts and other mental health challenges, so very high rates of access to mental health care and emergency departments, and community services, high rates of homelessness and unemployment. And the services, from what we've been able to see, are not adequately supporting trans and gender diverse people. And there is really no push or change to either shift that or to create specialized services for us. And in order to get those things, we really need the data to say, you know, it's a large proportion of the population that is significantly affected. You do need to fund these things. And we are not going to get that out of this census.
Thanks, Kai. Thanks.
Yeah, no worries. I'll see you around.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Job seekers could have their rights weakened, and some may lose hundreds of dollars in payments under a federal government plan to update mutual obligation rules. Welfare groups are warning that this proposed plan that supposedly streamlines social security law could have a huge impact on those currently looking for work. To discuss the proposed bill, I'm now joined by Jay Coonan. Jay is a research and policy officer for the Anti-Poverty Centre. Thanks very much for joining us this morning, Jay.
Thanks for having me.
Now, just to start with, I guess a lot of our listeners probably aren't even aware of this bill. It's very much, unfortunately, sort of floated under the radar for a lot of people, but it seems very reminiscent of the robo-debt scheme and other sort of demonising and penalising policy. Can I just start by asking, what exactly is being proposed and what potential impact will this bill have on job seekers?
Yeah, look, it is a pretty niche subject. So basically now, as I'm sure people will be aware, like when you go onto the JobSeeker payment, the main unemployment payment, you are required to do what are known as mutual obligations. So, you know, that's pretty much like a good way to summarize it is essentially like KPIs for the poor. So you do like apply for 20 jobs a month or attend certain courses and other things like that. And you're forced to do that, otherwise you lose your payments. And so generally you go into the office and you do that with what they call employment service providers. But generally they're just bureaucratic box tickers who are making sure that you're upholding the Social Security Act. And if you're not, then they cancel your payments. So that's pretty much what the system is now. But as of 1 July 2022, they're bringing in the new employment services model, which is set to digitize the employment services sector. So when what will happen is when people go onto the JobSeeker payment, they will have to sign what is known as a job plan, which you still do now. And pretty much what will occur during that job plan signing is you will also have to fill out a test, basically, which is an algorithm to decide whether or not you're capable of doing your own mutual obligations online, or to go to what is called what is known as enhanced services, which is basically where you just go to the office to be supported by someone. So what they're going to be relying on is basically an algorithm and a set of digital processes to oversee how people meet their mutual obligations.
Now, many of our listeners would be aware of the robo-debt scandal scheme, whatever you want to call it. I mean, that seems sort of blaringly obvious as a potential problem, that the digitization of these services has failed miserably in the past. Is that one of the main concerns from welfare groups at this point?
Yeah. So, look, I mean, it's like the Social Security sector is basically like when you can't tax somebody, you put them in debt. So you're just setting up all these different bureaucratic hurdles in which, you know, poor people have to achieve. And if they don't, then you can take money off of them or prevent them from getting money. So one important point is noting with the changes that is outlined in the Social Security amendments is Schedule 8 of the bill. Basically, what they're doing is they're delaying people from getting their payments. So generally, when you sign up and you get your payment, you just get it from when it's accepted. But what this bill is also going to do is it's going to delay people's payments until they sign or fill out their job plans as a part of the new employment services model. So, you know, if you're not a technologically savvy person, or you don't check your emails as frequently, or, you know, you've just got a bunch of other stuff going on in your life, you may miss that. So that may mean you could be up without a payment for upwards of like 7 days. And so this is basically a budgetary saving measure that they're introducing in order to take money from people who desperately need it. And it's just, yeah, it's just another callous act by the government, regardless of party.
Now, this is all occurring in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic, where many people are out of work. Of course, we've had the loss of the COVID-19 payments. There's been significant changes, I guess, to legislation around any support that was temporarily offered to people during the pandemic. Of course, particularly on the east coast of Australia, people are still very much suffering as a result of the pandemic. Why now would the government even propose this when things are clearly just getting worse? And as we, you know, potentially head into a sort of further recession, it's likely there'll be a high rates of unemployment. As you're saying there, is it just a sort of a cynical budget saving move, or is there something else going on?
Yeah, so I think, look, ideologically, it's aligned with what like the Liberal and National government or the coalition want to do, and that's just to find savings across the board in order to make those things. Like, so, you know, it's pretty much like a form of disaster capitalism. While everything's so chaotic and nobody can focus and the media is so distracted with COVID, they can sneak these things through where people would generally normally recognize, or they discuss it, there'd be more media time. But now at the moment, you're able to push through these, you know, pretty dubious amendments to, you know, make these budgetary savings. And, you know, like for another great example of that, now when you mentioned the increase to job seeker through the COVID supplement last year, they applied that to the job seeker payment. Student payments as well. And what they didn't tell people at the time is that was taxable income. So even though they were like looking like they were increasing and doing the right thing, they made it so they could claw it back come tax time in the 2021-22 year. And that's why they didn't extend it to, say, the disability support pension, which is an untaxable income, as they wouldn't have been able to retrieve it that way. Some elements of the age pension as well isn't taxable either. So that's probably why they didn't extend to the age pension either. So they look as though they're helping or trying to provide assistance for people. But what the social security system is, it's just a way for the government to try and retract payments when they normally couldn't tax somebody for it.
We're speaking to Jay Coonan from the Anti-Poverty Centre. Jay, I just wanted to ask you, one thing that often doesn't get discussed around, a tax on welfare and a tax on the unemployed is the relationship and the function of welfare, under our current economic system to wages and conditions. It's something I think that, you know, the government very much exploit is attacking our so-called dole bludgers and people on unemployment benefits. But there is obviously a direct correlation between the treatment of people on that are unemployed and wages and conditions. And I think we've seen that in the last couple of decades of neoliberal policy, in terms of as soon as there's an attack on the poor, whether that be the cashless, the basics cards or so forth, there will be an attack on wages and conditions. Can you speak to that and what the relationship is between how, you know, the amount of support offered to people in welfare and how that affects our sort of minimum wage and our just basic wages and conditions in this country?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, so basically the overall policy program of that neoliberal model is called like the welfare to work programs. And welfare to work programs aren't anything new. They were established under the Hawke and Keating governments, and then they were really ramped up around 1907 under John Howard, when the employment service provider sector was privatized. And then gradually over time, they're just getting worse and worse and worse. So the welfare to work basically is, you know, from the principle that, you know, a person needs to be forced in order to improve their material conditions. And to do that is to get into work. So they will make they just continuously constrict and destroy the social security net and the welfare state, which has been done, in order to force people to take up the most, you know, kind of bad job with terrible conditions, regardless of wage, so they're not going to be humiliated and, you know, degraded by the social security system. So then they're willing to take up low paid work, as I mentioned, and, you know, shittier conditions. So that's all that this is really designed to do, and another element of it, because you can talk to anybody who is, you know, being subjected for long periods of time with an employment services provider, and they feel like they're being treated like a child, they're threatened, they're bullied, to the point where they probably will just go and take work, or which is more increasing phenomenon, particularly in regional and rural Australia, is people just completely going out of the social security system altogether. So people are getting to the point now where they're willing to just go into hard, degrading poverty without any support, just to escape the brutalization of the system.
And I guess inversely as well, for those of us on, you know, lower socioeconomic areas and working jobs for minimum wage, it means that even if we have a job, we're more likely to accept terrible conditions, terrible wages, when there are a bunch of people being forced potentially into our job. And I guess that's something that isn't often talked about, the fact that this doesn't just affect people who are unemployed, it also affects those people who are underemployed as well.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, like, that's one of the most important things that we tried to push with the Australian Unemployed Workers Union when I was there. It's just, and, you know, we had some support from, established trade unions, was that, you know, once they start attacks on the unemployed, you know who they're coming for next. And that's people in part-time work, in full-time work. And you've seen that in the as a response to the COVID economic crisis. So, you know, they were wanting to reboot the economy after the initial lockdowns of 2020. And, you know, they had the ACTU, Sally McManus, at the bargaining table there with Christian Porter as the industrial relations minister, like, hacking out plans. And that was to, you know, weaken employment regulation, in, apparently, to get us all back to work. And to some degree, it did work. But what it is doing is creating poorer working conditions, less stable working conditions, and people aren't going to be finding sustainable and meaningful employment like they were. It's just slow, gradual cuts in order to pit people against each other without providing any support overall.
Just finally, Jay, if people are concerned about this proposed bill, is there anything they can do? And what's the best thing they can do to show their and demonstrate their opposition to these changes?
Yeah, so at the moment, like, it's kind of been funny because we've been expecting this bill to go forward quite recently, but it keeps getting pushed back and back, so which is in a way a good thing. So to get involved and to help out, you can just, if you're on Twitter, you can go check out the Australian Unemployed Workers Union to see some updates and even get involved there, or through their website, which is auwu.org. And you can also follow the Anti-Poverty Centre at Anti-Poverty Cent, C-E-N-T, and for more updates there. And we can also get in touch. And you can also email me. So that's just J-J-A-Y at antipovertycentre.org. And I can get you involved in any way you can help out.
We've been speaking to Jay Coonan from the Anti-Poverty Centre. Thanks very much for speaking to us this morning, Jay.
No worries. Thank you.
And that's almost it for the Indie Media Show. We're going to now quickly go to just a bit of Indie Media news. Journey?
Indigenous activists in Brazil are awaiting a critical decision by the Supreme Court, which would decide whether or not Indigenous land claims based on occupation prior to 1988 can be legally recognised, 1988 being long after many groups had been driven off their lands by colonisation. Rejection of these claims would lead to further deforestation and corporate development of the Amazon. Indigenous leaders say that the decision is critical to their survival.
And staying in Central and South America, in El Salvador, hundreds of people took to the streets of the capital, San Salvador, last week, protesting the adoption of Bitcoin as an official currency, making El Salvador the first nation in the world to do so. The law, spearheaded by President Nayib Bukele, takes effect this coming week. Critics warn of drastic fluctuations in cryptocurrency's value and say that Bitcoin is often used for money laundering.
In the occupied West Bank, a Palestinian mother has been released from an Israeli jail to give birth under house arrest in her home after a large public campaign and repeated denials by the Israeli state for a release on humanitarian grounds. During her pregnancy, she was held in solitary confinement and subject to brutal conditions after being arrested by the IDF for an altercation on an Israeli settlement outpost on her family's land. The family had to pay a US$12,000 bond for the rare release. Since 1972, 8 Palestinian women have been forced to give birth in Israeli prisons.
In the United States, in Texas, a near total ban on abortions went into effect last week after the US Supreme Court failed to rule on an emergency petition filed by abortion providers seeking to block the measure. The law bars abortions just 6 weeks into a pregnancy before many people even know that they're pregnant. There is no exception for rape or incest. The law also allows anyone in Texas to sue patients, medical workers, or even a patient's family or friends who aid and abet an abortion. Until now, no other 6-week abortion ban has been allowed to go into effect. Reproductive justice advocates have vowed to keep fighting. The American Civil Liberties Union tweeted, "This is a racial and economic catastrophe. This is a full-scale assault on patients, our healthcare providers, and our support systems."
Back in Australia, and a win for sex workers' rights in Victoria, with the state government moving to decriminalise sex work, repeal the 1994 Sex Work Act, remove an outdated licensing system, and subjecting it to standard workplace regulations. Private escorts will no longer need to register with the state, and street-based sex work will no longer be a criminal offence in most places. Victoria is the third jurisdiction to decriminalise after New South Wales and the Northern Territory. Similar moves are being made in Queensland. And to Will Cannia in Western New South Wales, and leaked letters show that the Morrison government ignored warnings by Marri Marr Aboriginal Health Corporation in March 2020, saying that Will Cannia's overcrowding, poor quality housing, lack of food security and other factors could lead to disaster in the majority Indigenous community during the pandemic. The letters recommended fully functioning quarantine facilities and support for those isolating at home. New South Wales Health has finally set up quarantine motorhomes in the town to help stem the spread of COVID. 13% of the town of 800 already have the virus.
And that's all we have time for today on the Indie Media Show. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thanks so much, Joni.
Oh, thank you. Good to be here.
We'll be back next week at 11 a.m. But you can always restream the show at rtrfm.com.au or find us on a podcast as well on that website, or listen to our individual interviews at SoundCloud. Keep it locked, though, as coming up very, very shortly, Rhiann Todd-Hunter is taking you out to lunch, all your new music needs for a Monday afternoon. But as we say every week,
don't hate the media.
Become the media.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?